Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Thunder Buddies podcast. I'm Eric Horn, here with Maddie Lee at the Oklahoma Studios. Maddie?
Yeah.
That's all you got?
Oh, was it? Well, do I get to introduce the other Maddie?
Say things.
Well, I'm glad to be back. I had someone compliment us on our last couple podcasts, and I wasn't on the last one or the one before that. So.
But when you say couple, you were on the one before the last one
we did with Jason Quick. I was in the middle there.
You were there. Take credit.
Yeah. Yeah. I did that one really good. glad to be back from my family reunioning. Grandma just turned 93, so...
She's proud of your podcasting too.
Yeah, I don't think she knows how to listen to podcasts, but
you should turn her on to that before it's too late. I say that in the nicest way possible.
That hurt a little bit, I'll call her up and I'll let her know.
It shouldn't hurt because she's lived a great life at 93. I'm just saying, just get her into the podcast. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, I'll work on it. We're still working on the basic smartphone usage, but yeah, I'll put that app front and center. Now that Eric's told me my grandma's about to die.
I didn't say that.
We would love to introduce our newest guest and pivot away from this. Matt Moore is joining us.
Matt?
I'm so excited. Like, one, like, Thunder Buddies is such a great name for this pod. I'm excited. I want to get a t-shirt that says Thunder Buddies. And then this, like, got really dark when, like, Eric just, like... bringing up like the darkness of human mortality.
But that's the thing. It's right there in front of us. Maddie's grandmother's lived an incredible life of 93 years.
She really has.
In the time that we have left, introduce her to the Thunder Buddies podcast.
I think it'll really I would recommend
the same to anyone in your life, Maddie, who is not 93.
Would you say before it's too late?
Before it's too late. Look, if you're 40 something years old, or 30 something years old, and you were at Maddie's family reunion before it's too late. please listen and subscribe to the Thunder Buddies podcast.
Matt, I'm gonna.
Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
I think we should do t-shirts. We should do like Thunder Buddy t-shirts for our guests.
And we should say before it's too late on the t-shirt.
That's our new slogan.
Subscribe before your fragile shell of body passes from the mortal coil.
And we should we're not going to age discriminate here. Like I said, it's not because you're 90 something. You could be 12, and if you listen to the Thunder Buddies podcast before it's too late.
How did you make this more subscribe. Morbid?
I'm just saying, people. There's so much opportunity here.
We've lost all of our listeners.
We haven't. Because people are having moments of clarity right now. We haven't lost listeners. We've gained listeners. We've gained people who believe in our ethos. Like, anyway, Matt, can you give people an idea of what you do for the Action Network and why you are here with us today on the Thunder Buddies podcast?
Sure.
So before it's too late.
Before it's too late, right. Yes.
I'm a senior writer for the NBA for the Action Network. We're a new site. Not as new as we used to be. About 18 months old. And we started as we take kind of the sports coverage melding of analytics and news information and reporting to sports betting and daily fantasy. And so I do a lot of just deep dives on NBA subjects, covering the MVP race, team over unders, odds to make various things like odds to make the playoffs, odds to win divisions, and take like a real basketball centric look at those things. I went to Oklahoma City last year and hung out with you fine folks and was a Thunder Buddy in real life for a short period of time.
It's been fun.
Talked to Paul George, and that was great, and hung out there for a couple of days and did a lot of stories on that. So, you can find all that stuff at the Action Network and download our app.
Now, we can get into a lot of the things that you feel about the NBA, but I wanted to give people a little bit of an idea of how I got into your work. And I mean, I've been following you obviously I think anybody who reads basketball should read your work, whether it's what you're doing now. Wait, what?
Before it's too late.
Before it's too late. Exactly. I mean, you're a great Twitter follow, HP Basketball. I love that. I love what you do there.
Yeah, that's how I started following you. It was years ago. Someone was like, this guy's Twitter is great. You should follow him. I was like, okay.
But there's this one story I think you wrote that I'll never forget. And it was about, I can't remember what season it was. It might have been after the Warriors' first title with Durant. And I think you wrote something that a lot of people weren't really writing about at the time. I think we're all kind of complaining about the inevitability of this. And you wrote, rather, you took it from the angle that the rest of the, this isn't a bad thing that the Warriors did this, but the rest of the league has to catch up. And that was that's to paraphrase what you wrote. And you can correct me on that if you're wrong. And that how it was a good thing that the Warriors did this because they kind of expanded, you know, the capabilities of basketball and what we've seen up to that point. And the rest of the league, it was up to them to kind of elevate their game and their way of looking at the game and their way of looking at efficient shot making and how to play. And I think that we have seen the level of the league elevate because of the Warriors. And I think that you were kind of ahead of the curve when it came to talking about the Warriors and the way that we should view them, rather than just saying that they're a team that's going to just destroy the league. Because I'd argue we've seen some of the best basketball. And we've seen the talent level of the NBA at its highest than we've ever seen, you know, probably since the mid-'80s when you had such great teams from the Lakers and the Celtics.
Yeah, so first off, I want to commend you for not only going from human mortality to then talking about great the Warriors
Thank
are.
Quick segue.
Talking about how great the Warriors are on a Thunder podcast. Like, you were just winning friends.
Yeah. That's what I do.
And right. But now, so a lot of it was I was actually – I'm always trying to regulate towards the most accurate position. So I'm trying to bring if everybody's like, this team is garbage, I'm like, okay, they're probably not as bad as we talk about unless they're the Knicks. And if and so when the Warriors just like slayed everybody in 2015-16, I was like, this is really concerning to me that one team is this dominant. And then they got Durant. And I was like, this is really bad. And then they won the title. And I was like, you know, everyone's expecting me to write something that's along the lines of this is so terrible and the NBA has no point. And I was like, I really did think about it. And I was like, look, this is a copycat league. It's always been a copycat league. We've seen that over and over again, how teams will look at what's been successful and try and implement that with their own personnel. And, you know, a perimeter-oriented game with lots of passing, with smart cuts, and a model where a bunch of superstar players are willing to share and sacrifice, that's only going to make for better basketball. And I think that it has. I think that we've seen, you know, I would say that if you compare the worst teams in the league last year, except for the Knicks, and then like the worst teams in the league from like 2002, you would take those 2019 teams almost every time because they just play a more pleasing brand of basketball. It's smarter. It's more efficient. It's I think there's better athleticism. I think that a lot of those things are just a product of how the game evolves over time. But I do think the Warriors set the bar for, you know, the Wizards, I think, are a great example of this. A lot of bad things happened to the Wizards. But one thing that became clear even before John Wall's really unfortunate series of injuries was that you can't play this style where you're not maximizing what you have. If you have all this talent, it doesn't matter if you don't make the most out of it. And I think that's what fans most want to see, is they want to see teams make the most out of what they have.
It's interesting you mention that style of having a ton of superstars coming together and, you know, sacrificing and making it work. Where did you expect or ever predict that we'd end up here where we're now? I mean, obviously, a lot of the influences in style of play continue on, but now we're splitting off into duos here. Where do you see that in the evolution, and how do you make sense of why that's happening?
So I looked back at the history of the league for an article that I wrote this summer. And we have kind of this idea that there have been these super teams throughout history. But when you look at their usage rates and you look at their actual production in terms of like whatever stat you want to use, whatever advanced metric, win shares or VORP, any of these things, if you use that as a guideline, this trend kind of emerged, which was take the 87 Celtics. You had Bird and you had McHale, and most people would be like, oh, but don't forget about Chief. And it's true. Parrish was a big part of that. But Parrish was noticeably lower in usage and production than the other two. And you look at the Bulls and their first run with Jordan and Pippen and Horace Grant, and later with Rodman, and you see the same thing.
But
third guy who's willing to be essentially a hyper augmented role player. And in Golden State, it worked for a while because you had KD and Steph, and at times Steph and then KD, and then basically Klay and Draymond combined into one player because you have perimeter shooting and you have playmaking with Draymond's passing, which is really underrated, and then their defense combined. And that was one of the reasons, like, having two of those guys that could be at that level, you know, is one of the reasons that they're amongst the best players, I think, of all time. So it's not – when I looked back, it was like, you know what? This actually has been kind of the model, that you have two guys – and then a third really great role player that kind of fills in that gap. And oftentimes it's a star player that does that, but that's been a kind of a consistent model throughout time. I think the Warriors, Durant leaving, is kind of proof that there is a limit to how much you can have, because everybody is kind of, they want some level of billing, and some guys are fine. Like, you guys having covered Paul George, I'd be curious as to your thoughts on this. I think he's totally fine with being both the spokesman, but also, like, not necessarily, you know, I tried really hard to stay away from in the article using the term alpha and beta males, because those terms have become so toxic in today's discussions amongst various terrible groups of humans. But, you know, in terms of the actual, like, pack dynamics, it does kind of work where there's one leader and then there's one supporting player. I think Paul George is probably fine being that supporting player and being, you know, taking over some of the spokesperson roles that Kawhi clearly doesn't want to do. Even though he's capable of being an MVP-level player, I don't think he's threatened by having to not necessarily be the number one guy on the marquee.
Yeah, I'd absolutely agree.
I agree with that. And I don't know if you picked that up from being around Paul in the time that you were with him when you were here, but he's a very agreeable personality. And in particular, in contrast to a guy like Russell Westbrook, who's very, who's very A-type, very, you know, you feel his presence when he's in a room in every occurrence, and you feel his presence on the court every minute. Whereas Paul can kind of, for better or worse, he can kind of just drift in and out of games. Sometimes he can kind of just be passive. But he's obviously a tremendous player. And when he was on his roll, he was, you know, one of the top three guys in the league. But yeah, there are particular personality types that I think lend themselves to how guys play on the court and how they go in and out of games. And I think that the Warriors were unique in that sense, in that, you know, while Draymond you would probably look at as the most demonstrative personality of that group, the most talented shooters and offensive players in terms of the guys able to, you know, make 3-point baskets and score are guys that are more of those closer to Paul George type personalities, more of a Klay Thompson, more of a Steph Curry type. That's willing to kind of say, okay, I don't need to dominate the ball. I don't need to, be of this kind of in your face kind of personality.
Yeah, and I'd argue that it's one of the reasons that everyone will always kill Oklahoma City for the decisions that they made or that were made for them along the way. But I do think that that's, you know, if we follow this paradigm, it helps explain a lot of what happened, because I don't think that James Harden was ever going to be okay with being third billing on the marquee. I don't think he was going to be okay being second billing on the marquee. I think he's more okay maybe now sharing that with Russ, but that's kind of the question. And Russ is clearly never going to be okay with that. He was always going to be, you know, pushing for the highest spot on the marquee. And I think, you know, Kevin Durant was never going to be comfortable trying to hold somebody off of that, right? Like, that's part of what's frustrated him with Golden State, was even though Steph was completely willing to be like, no, it's like, you're the guy. You're the guy. I just want to win. Everyone else was like, yeah, but Steph's like the guy.
Right.
Yeah.
And that bothered him. And so I think if you, from that perspective, it doesn't matter how much talent you had. You can't shape personalities. That's not your role as a team. You can then try and instill culture and try and accommodate and try and teach But you can't shape personality. And in that way, you know, maybe from the get-go, no matter how good OKC was and for a long time was a really great team, maybe they were always doomed because of that.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons I really wanted to get you on the podcast too, Matt, is because I think you've taken some of the more rational perspectives on the Thunder and their regime. I almost called it a dynasty. Their regime.
Yeah, a few more rings for that.
Particularly on Twitter. You know, there tend to be extremes when it comes to the Thunder. There are a lot of people who are, you know, pro-player. There are a lot of people who are, you know, kind of pro-management. But there are also a lot of people who are just pretty anti-Presti, starting with the Harden trade. But I think you've taken a nice middle ground, or you've looked at it from a perspective that not a lot of people really do. And I think that there are a lot of factors that went into why the Thunder didn't win a championship that are more than just binary, than just saying, well, Sam Presti didn't get players, or, well, Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook didn't do this, or, well, these guys were grappling for position as the alpha, or, you know, Scott Brooks and Billy Donovan aren't good coaches or whatever. I think there are a lot of things that went into why this team didn't win one or two titles. And some of these things I don't think can be properly explained by just lumping everything into one corner and saying, well, it's this fault, it's this fault. It's a lot of factors that come together at once. And I think that you've taken a really interesting perspective on that throughout the years.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is that there are these kind of themes that evolve, not only, I think, in basketball, but when you're paying attention to successful companies or leaders or nonprofit organizations or anything that you kind of delve into. And one of the things you consistently find is the idea of setting people up to succeed. And whether they succeed or not is often the product of luck and fate. And you know, self-discipline and a lot of things that are very difficult to control, but you want to set people up to succeed. And that's something that, you know, in people's careers, everyone's looking for that, is they want to be in a position where they feel like I can do my job to the best of my ability and hopefully move further in my career. Like everybody wants that. And I think with Oklahoma City, that was always, you know, my takeaway is like they set that team up to succeed. They did draft the right players. They did develop them the right way. They put teams around them, and people say the shooting. And it was a concern. Like, I think you have to look at it and say he probably should have gone at some point and just paid through the nose to get an elite level shooter to pair with them. It's easier said than done, but that's the job of the GM, is like you have to make that call. But at the same time, when we look at that era of Russ and KD, you know, you're talking about Western Conference Finals in 2011, the Finals in 2012, the Western Conference Finals in 2014, and the Western Conference Finals in 2016. And there were injuries along the way, even in those years. And the other 2 years, either Russ or Durant were out with injury. And like, I have a really hard time with why it is that a coach can make a Final Four, like, you know, 5 times in 8 years, and we talk about him as one of the best coaches ever. And then in the NBA, you make the Western Conference Finals and you're a loser who can't get the job done. And like, that's just crazy, man. And granted, the stakes are a little bit different because it's pro sports, but, you know, that's a good example of, you know, kind of how it goes. And I think that Oklahoma City, I think that Presti put the team in a position to succeed. He didn't always put them in the best position to succeed, but he was honest and he worked to try and put them, you know, toward that every single year. And the reality is when I look at it, I go, you know, Ibaka's injury in that Western Conference Finals series where he missed the first 2 games, that was killer. I look at the 2 years, like 2013, that team was outrageously good. And they got hurt, and that was, you know, that was it. And then 2016, Klay Thompson has what is universally still the most surreal shooting explosion I've ever witnessed in person. Like, I was at that game, and I did not feel like I was in reality. It was like I was walking through some sort of mystical realm. It was just bizarre after the game, trying to comprehend what Klay Thompson had done. And you put all that together, and I have a hard time condemning the Thunder. Instead of being pretty honest about, they had a really good run. It didn't work out for a lot of reasons, which I think over time, I will say this, I think in time, there will be a lot of revelations of exactly why various things happened the way they did, and they won't look the way that they do now as people continue to blame everything on Presti.
I think that's a good segue into talking about the future, if you guys are ready to move on from the past.
We can be futury. We can be futuristic.
So you wrote, Matt, you wrote a story about how it was a overreaction for you see the predictions for win totals dropping down to like 30 or 30.5. I think at this point now most betting sites have them at like 31.5, 32.5. Why is it that low? Because for me, it like, yeah, they're not going to be great. And there's a lot of things that are up in the air, but, and I'm terrible at betting, so no one should ever take my advice on
this is why we have Matt on the podcast, because I think Maddie and I are both not great when it comes to the gambling aspect of
the stuff. So, like, are you putting down money at this point? How do you digest all this?
So I'm working right now, and I'm about ready to start the Thunder section. I write every year now for Action. I do rankings for all of the over-unders, whether to take the over or the under, based on my confidence level. And the Thunder will be pretty low on the confidence level, even though I have them slated at 37 wins currently. The lowest you can get them at is 31.5. And those are the Vegas books at both Caesar and Westgate. Notably, those books are sharper than the newer books that operate on the East Coast, like FanDuel and DraftKings, because those books are dealing with volume. And so they're a little bit higher in some instances, and there's a little bit more variance there. The highest I've seen is 34.5 at FanDuel. And then points bet is 32.5. So you've got this range from basically 31.5 to 34.5. At 31.5, I like the over pretty well. I still think that even if in all sort of the range of outcomes, which is how I approach the over-unders, like if you go through the multiverse and you see all of the different ways that this could play out, how many instances does a team go under? How many teams do they go under? And obviously there's a range where, you know, it's a no bet because the world explodes or whatever. But in all those instances, like how many times?
At that point, it doesn't matter.
Right. It doesn't matter. You don't have to pay.
It's too late.
Right. So you in those situations, I think the 31.5 is a playable number for the over, but I don't have a lot of confidence in it. And the reason is, having had a few conversations with folks with the Thunder, I don't think that there's they will enter training camp with a very clear, like, nope, we want to win. We believe in these guys. We got Chris. We got Steven. We think we're underrated. We think we can make some noise. And I think that that's probably genuine. The problem is if it doesn't work, if they crater out of the gate, which happens a lot of the time when a foundational piece like Russell Westbrook leaves.
Mm-hmm. And their schedule in November is brutal.
Mm-hmm. So if they get off to a rough start, there's got to be a point at which, you know, Presti will look and say, okay, you know, maybe if that offer that I solicited, you know, back in July, if that's still on the table, you can get Steven Adams, you know, you can get Chris Paul, you can get whoever else is left on the roster. And once you start taking away pieces, now you're really transitioning to, you know, actively trying to lose games. If Chris Paul has an injury and, you know, just sits out the season at some point, that's obviously, I think, going to hurt him, even though I think everybody's really high on Gilgeous Alexander, including myself. Like, there's a lot of reasons. But if we just look at what the team on the roster, if we just open up the roster page and look at that team, I was really shocked to see these numbers as low as they were. So I was like, Chris Paul, Danilo Gallinari, Steven Adams, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Those four players should get you into 30-win territory pretty easily. And then, like, you know, good coaching from Billy Donovan and a decent cast of role players, even in a brutal Western Conference. Like, that team in the Eastern Conference, I would already be slotting in for, like, a sixth seed. So at that point, I still think the over is a pretty good play, but it's one of those where you want to be cautious because of the possibility of a fire sale at midseason that could wind up really, really burning you.
And the Thunder is in a position right now, too, where they have to look long, long term, because right, they're not going to be sustainably good anytime soon. And they don't want to, you know, ruin the chances of being good sustainably sooner by throwing in all their chips now. So really, they're not, I mean, even though they have so many picks, they're not looking at, you know, if we take away their own picks, they're not looking at any top five pick, unless Miami is awful out of nowhere.
Really, for all the draft capital they have, the only thing they really have control over is their own picks in the next 7 years. You can say all you want about, you know, what are the Clippers going to look like in this many years, or what are the Rockets going to look like in this many years, to where
but they don't know.
Those are valuable, but you don't know. All you can control is the picks you own, and the Thunder can control that by trading guys. Which leads to me, in my next question, Matt, is are there any other teams in the league that are as unpredictable in terms of from a gambling standpoint as the Thunder? Can you think of any other teams at this moment where you would be like, I have no idea, or the swings between the win totals are as drastic as this Thunder team entering this season?
So I think that the number, like the numbers are always pretty sharp, and that's what you kind of pay attention to. I think that if you're like the Rockets, I think are a good example of this, of, you know, with Russ, going from like their range is from 52 to 54 and a half. And that may be like, well, we know that they're going to be a pretty good team. Like you can expect, like there's no scenario in which you would go, the Rockets are going to win under 47 games. Like you just wouldn't think that. But the gap between 47 and 52 and a half is actually pretty considerable. That's a lot of things that have to go your way. And that's subject to a lot of the whims of fate and how close games go and whatnot. The other one, I think that, you know, Indiana is another one that you look at. Their win total is between 46 and a half and 47 and a half. It's pretty consistent across the board at one of those two numbers. You know, we don't know what Victor Oladipo, when he's going to be back. We don't know what he's going to look like. There are those that say that injury is something that nobody really comes back from, and I want to fade that. And then you got people that say, like, you know, there's been like lots of positive signs out of Indiana. The noise is that he really could be back by January, and their closing schedule is soft, so there's like an opportunity for them to push late. Those kind of things, I think, come into play. Most of the Eastern Conference, I think, has a lot of uncertainty, just based off of everyone's so bad. Like the Orlando Magic, like the Orlando Magic is at like 42 and a half. And I don't know really what to do with that number. Cause I don't think that they're like a 45 win team, but I definitely, you know, think that it's hard for them to lose.
Yeah.
It's hard for them not to win at least 40 in the Western or in the Eastern Conference, given how bad the rest of the, and their division in particular. So I think that creates some instability. There are a few. I think the other one is really the Raptors. You know, their win total is about is between 45 and a half and 46 and a half. And there's a lot of questions about, okay, there's so many really good players on that team. Obviously, as they won a title, what does the championship hangover look like for a team with so many guys in Kyle Lowry, Serge Ibaka, and Marc Gasol at this point in their careers at that age, all on expiring contracts, mind you, or, you know, two of them at least on expiring contracts. And, you know, Masai Ujiri, who knows, like, I won a title and now I can transition to the next thing. You wonder if he'll try and get ahead of the curve on some of this. Those are, I think, the teams that you look at and really have a lot of questions about the certainty of where they're going to land.
Yeah, they're kind of Thunder East in that regard. I don't even know what I was going to say there, but they're kind of Thunder East in the regard that there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of their roster. I think
they could make moves at midseason and just dramatically shift directions.
Yeah.
That's the similarity.
How much does all the player movement, especially with those big name free agents, affect your confidence in anyone's long, because I mean, once you start looking at the playoffs, you're like, oh, we know that the Clippers are going to be good. But it's like, how long, when is Paul George going to be healthy, and how long is it going to take for them to gel? And you can say, like, you can pick apart a bunch of these teams and say similar things.
Yeah, so doubt is a lot harder than it was last year or the year before to try and establish what these numbers should be, or where you should, you know, whether the number is soft or too high. You know, I think it's exciting in that there has to be a level of confidence that the books can't know either. As sharp as the books are, and they are extremely sharp about these things, that's why they make all the money they do. There's still an opportunity there because of the uncertainty. Like the Lakers, I think, actually have suffered from a bit of an overreaction in terms of for the first time, I think they're being overly criticized. Their number is lower than I kind of expected. It's 50. You can get it at 50 at Westgate and 51.5 in most of the East Coast books. For a team that always generates so much public push, like you have to kind of give them an extra 2 just for the amount of money that people bet on them because there's so many Lakers fans. That seems, if you push that down to back down to 49.5, now you're like, I don't know, Anthony Davis, LeBron James, and a decent core seems like a 50-win team to me. Like that all of a sudden seems pretty soft as a number versus the Clippers where they're higher. And yet I don't really know what to expect of them. I think that Paul George injury is still something that most casual bettors, which the books are banking on, don't really know about. Like nobody's really talked about, look, Paul George may not be around for, the first 6 months or first 6 weeks of the season as a worst case scenario. He may miss 2 weeks, and every single one of these is going to matter because there's also going to be load management. There's also going to be like recovery time. We don't know. Like those are questions. I've got a big story coming out today actually about rest management and about where the league thinks it's going to be. And there's a huge disparity between what the league expects, which is the league expects like, no, I don't think it's going to be that big of a deal. And the executives I talked to were like, it's absolutely going to be a big deal. Some of them anyway, some agree with the league. So these are all factors I think that make for a little bit of chaos, but it also I think increases the margin on your comfort zone. If you feel like you have a really good feel for what a team's going to do.
Big continuity team, Matt. Your Denver Nuggets, and I say your Denver Nuggets because you live in Denver. You still live in Denver, right?
I do.
Okay, just making sure. I know everybody's moving around this summer; it's crazy. But how do you feel about Denver? Maddie and I thought they were both going to be a one seed, and this will be a segue into we can get into your Western Conference rankings. They're one of the teams that has the most continuity from last season. And then you're adding a guy in Michael Porter Jr. that basically everyone doesn't really know what he's about in terms of an NBA play because he hasn't played any, but they're high on. How do you feel about Denver and Western Conference?
I'm actually fading them a little bit.
Interesting.
So they're at 52.5, which is a strong number, and they won more than that last season. But if we look at kind of how last season went, there's a lot that you really have to pay attention to. So they missed Will Barton for about 3 months. They missed Gary Harris and Paul Millsap for a month. And so when you look at that and you look at their win total last year and you go, oh, with Michael Porter Jr. and with Jeremy Grant, who everyone is very excited that they were able to get, the front office was doing cartwheels when Presti agreed. This should be over. Like they could be a one seed. However, introducing rookies into a competitive environment is tough because they have to be able to play at a level to where the coach can afford to have them on the floor and not bleed. And typically rookies just bleed in plus minus. Kevin Durant's first 2 seasons, he was one of the league's worst in plus minus because the team was bad, but also because it takes rookies a long time to figure out how to contribute in winning ways and manage the game and all that.
Which is what's so impressive, just to jump in right here, which is why people should be so encouraged by Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. He was really one of like the plus minus darlings, and he was still a minus, but it was a very small minus compared to a lot of his rookies. I think he was maybe like top 3 or 4 in terms of rookie plus minus last year.
Yeah, and it's one of the reasons why I actually really pushed for Steven Adams to win Rookie of the Year. His rookie season was whenever you're a rookie that can contribute to winning teams as a starter, that's a big deal. Like, that's very difficult. So there's questions about, like, MPJ's health is the first concern. Then it's how is he going to work inside of a system where he's going to have to make quick decisions? He's naturally tends to grab the ball and hold it. And that's going to, if he does that a lot, Jokic is going to yell at him, and then he's going to get pulled for messing up the offense. And that's before we get to the defensive side.
I just don't know who he's going to guard. Yeah.
Yeah. They're very excited about Bol Bol. They're actually really excited about him, but I don't know if he's going to actually be able to get on the floor. So the rookies, you don't really know. Grant is obviously going to be a boost for them. But the question there is, where does he play? Do they play him at 3 in a supersized lineup? Do they play him at 4? Does he come off the bench behind Millsap? Does Millsap go to the bench? These are all questions. And then the biggest one, this is the biggest reason I'm fading them. Nikola Jokic had the longest basketball season of his career. He played into late May with a grueling series against the Blazers. He played 2 7-game series. He had 2 months off, and then he went to play for Serbia because he felt it was his obligation. Yeah. And that goes, he's got a few weeks, and training camp here starts in 2 weeks. And for he's been really good about his conditioning, despite how he looks. He's in really great conditioning shape. But I think mentally, he's a guy that gets really exhausted mentally. He gets very fatigued emotionally. And I think that that's going to be something that they have to keep an eye on. And I think it's something they have to honestly, you know, consider some load management with. And every time Jokic is on the floor, he's one of those guys that really does make the difference for his team. So that's a reason, all of those reasons combined with a little bit of regression in some of their clutch. They were the best clutch team in the league last season. All of these things kind of indicate that I think that the Nuggets by the end of the season will be a better team than last year, but I think they'll finish with fewer wins.
I might have to move around.
This is why we bring. This is why you bring Matt on the podcast
before we put our picks in the print paper.
Yes, and this and this is also why anyone who listens to the Thunder Buddies podcast, look, you can take our opinions and bring them to the bar or share them with your friends or whatever, but don't take them to bet. Don't bet with our opinions because Matt knows what he's talking about and we don't know crap. Because we can just go out here and say, oh, yeah, we like Denver. Continuity. They look really good. Nikola Jokic. No, man. Matt thinks about this stuff for a living and how it affects people's pockets. So we're
not thinking about your money.
I am not invested in your pockets, people who listen to the Thunder Buddies podcast. I don't care about your money. Your money's your own prerogative. I'm just looking at what I think from a basketball perspective and who I think is going to win or lose. But perfect segue, Matt. Usually we've done this with writers in the past couple weeks. Take us through the Western Conference, how you think things are going to fall out or end up. And if we get to something interesting, we stop, kind of discuss it a little bit. We usually start 1 through 8, then we go 8, then we go 9 to 15. If you'd humor us, 1 through 8, who do you have in the Western Conference making the playoffs, and what's the order?
I have the Houston Rockets and Utah Jazz tied for the one seed at 55 wins.
The Rockets at one.
I'm already excited. Can we talk about that?
This is good. Let's talk about this because I think I had the Rockets at around 4.
Yeah, I did too. I had Utah and Houston 3 and 4.
And we could talk about the win totals too because I just don't think – I mean, the Western Conference is just so brutal that I don't think there's going to be a lot of – differentiation between, you know, like maybe your 3 through 8 or your 4 through 8, kind of similar to, I think, the year that the Thunder had all of their injuries. You know, it comes down to the last day where you're deciding basically seeds 2 through 7, and you're figuring out the last day where all of these teams are going. What makes you bullish on the Rockets? And I think we kind of have an idea of why Utah is getting a lot of love. But what makes you bullish on the Rockets being a one seed this year?
So 2017, the first year with D'Antoni and Harden before Chris Paul arrived, 55 wins. The following season, 67 wins. Last year, 54 wins, and that was with Chris Paul out for a long stretch of time and Clint Capella out for a long stretch of time. So you have this, like, you have a pattern that basically says, you know, really, no matter what, if you've got Mike D'Antoni, James Harden, and a mostly healthy roster, which you kind of have to, like, you can factor in some of that into your analysis, but you got to be, you know, careful with it. You don't want to go too far in either direction. With a reasonable amount of injuries, that's a formula for 55 wins. And that's honestly, like, really the crux of it is I have questions about Russ and Harden. I have questions about, you know, the tension with Termon Fertitta and everything that he's put on the team. All the comments, Mike D'Antoni's contract situation, like everything, like this all, like, to me seems like there's a lot of tension points in there. But what we've seen from the Rockets is that those have all been there and they don't really explode until the playoffs. Then the regular season, they are just kind of a machine. And the reality is, the Rockets will beat the teams that are worse. I break all these things into how do you perform versus teams worse than you, the same as you, and better than you. And most people would think, like, well, of course you're just going to perform better versus worse teams. And that's not always true. Like, there are a lot of teams.
See the Thunder.
Yeah. Yep. Like, there are teams like the Thunder and the Wizards that have been basically, like, pretty middling versus those bad teams. The San Antonio Spurs are a lock for their over every season because I went back and looked at this. They've won 80% of their games versus teams under 500 over the last 10 years. They've won 80% of their games. They they do not slip. The Rockets are so explosive. They're not as disciplined as San Antonio, but they're so explosive that they'll just out, even when they have, like, there are nights and they clearly don't care. Like Harden had one of those 50-point triple doubles versus the Knicks just before New Year's a couple of years ago,
and it was clear that
one of those. And it was clear that like the Rockets were just like coasting to get to New Year's, like they were ready for, to let loose and have some fun. And they were not playing well, and they weren't really giving it like a focused effort on either end, and yet they just like blasted the Knicks because the Knicks are awful.
I'm sorry. So you think the Knicks are fantastic, right?
Right.
That's the impression
that's
I've
the
gotten.
Theme that's
yeah,
come
yeah.
out.
Overarching theme.
So anyway, that's kind of like my thought process is like, even if things aren't great, I think that things could start out kind of rough, and then you're going to look up in January and be like, oh, they're 10 games over 500. Like that's, they just are going to rack up enough wins to get little pushes. I think that they're, I think, not extremely, but they're a reasonably safe bet for 55 wins, just based off of the history between Harden and D'Antoni.
Okay. Who do you have behind those two at the top?
I've got the Clippers third at 53 wins. I've got, and that may go down as I continue to kind of fade the Clippers. I've got the Lakers right behind them at 52. So the top four are Rockets, Jazz, Clippers, Lakers. The fifth seed is the Nuggets at 50. I have the Warriors at 50 wins tied with the Nuggets at the sixth seed. I have the Blazers in seventh with 48, and I have the San Antonio Spurs once again eking past the poor Sacramento Kings, 46 wins to 45.
Now, I find it interesting that you have as many 50-win teams as you have, which
I do.
Would lead to believe that you're going to have some horrendous teams on the back end. Which I guess we'll get into in the second half of this, but I find it interesting that you project as many 51 teams as you had.
Yeah, so that's one thing that makes me nervous when I first did the run, and I've tweaked it since then. I'm on like version 6 now. I keep coming back to these numbers, and the reason is I think that somebody's going to fill the vacuum. So I think that one of these teams, the Jazz, the Clippers, the Rockets, maybe the Nuggets, like that's definitely possible. I'm not ruling it out. Even the Lakers could come in. I won't even leave the Warriors out of it. Could come in and just blow everybody away and win 60-62. And they'll take wins from all those other teams mm-hmm. and knock them down a little bit. But as of now, we have this level of parity. We don't know who's going to come out. Like, we don't know who's going to separate themselves. We know that most of these teams should be good. Like, I'll guarantee, like, I'm going to be wrong on, you know, at least two of these of those top ones on in terms of the over unders, just because there's going to be this variance from what occurs in terms of somebody gets hurt or they drop out or one team just performs, you know, ultimately way better than we expected. I'm kind of waiting to see who that is, but from where we are now, you kind of have to put all these teams even, because there isn't a team that you can look at and go, no, we know that team is the team. That is the team in the West. They're all really good, but they all have at least one question mark.
Who do you have? Let's go through 9 to 15. Who do you have as the first team out in the Western Conference?
First team out, the poor Kings. I've got them at 44 wins. I really like the Kings. I like what they've done, but actually, when I went back and watched a lot of clips this summer, I found that even though he gave the fans a heart attack and he was not great in the locker room, that Willie Cauley-Stein did a lot for them in terms of their offense. They don't have a lob threat to pair with De'Aaron Fox right now. I think that's going to give them a little bit of issues. That's why I don't have them higher. I also just think that, you know, they're still young and they're still trying to figure it out. And the Western Conference is tough, and I'm not willing to bail on the Spurs yet. And so until that happens, I think that they get the nod. And so they got the Kings as the first team out. I've got the Pelicans. Go ahead.
Kings-wise, how do you think the coaching change, if at all, is going to affect them?
I'm still waiting to see what happens with Luke Walton, but I think, you know, assuming he's gonna coach, there shouldn't be much of a change, because Jaeger had actually kind of gone all in on pushing for speed. Like, he had them at a fast pace last season. Walton will push much of the same. They're too young to be a good defensive team. Like, I expect them to look mostly the same based off of their athleticism, talent level, and inexperience. They're going to be really good offensively, I think, and really pretty rough defensively. If they get a boost there from somebody, if they're just better than expected defensively, then that can, I think, really move them up. But I think that their best they can really hope for is middling. If they turn into, obviously, like a top 12-ish defensive team, I think that raises their ceiling considerably.
Yeah, I liked Willie Cauley-Stein as a buy low guy for Golden State. I mean, he just seems like one of the guys that goes to Golden State and gets better. You know, we bang on a JaVale McGee and those guys for being on Shaqton and all that stuff throughout their career, but they typically go to Golden State and they find that they're around better players and they're around a culture that's going to make them better. And I feel like that there's an upside there for D'Angelo Russell too. I know there's some fit concerns in terms of D'Angelo Russell being a ball-dominant guy, but I think you unlock different parts of his game playing with a Steph Curry or a Draymond Green, and he's a great passer, and he was coming out of college in Ohio State. So I just think that Golden State gives guys a little bit more of an upside play, and the Willie Cauley-Stein thing, I think people are going to see that he's a better player than he made out to be when he was with the Kings.
If he manages to stay in the rotation until Clay gets back, I think he's going to be in a good spot, because the thing with JaVale was they just didn't ask him to do much. Just, you know, finish lobs, dunk the ball, you know, show your presence when a guy drives one-on-one, try not to get beat too often, which JaVale still did, and that was evident in all the numbers. But that's the same kind of thing with Stein. It's just like, look, all you really got to do is catch the lobs and finish them from Draymond when he's on the short roll, because they're going to have to blitz Steph.
Yeah.
You know, having that weapon, I think, just giving a guy a roll and being like, we don't need you to do much, just do this. I will say that the minutes when D'Angelo Russell and Willie Cauley-Stein are on the floor together, somebody better keep an eye on Kerr's blood pressure, because that's gonna be a problem.
So you had the Kings, and then you had, who was the next team? You said the Pelicans?
The Pelicans. I got the Pelicans at 42, and I wanted them higher.
Oh, I love their roster. I love their roster.
Isn't that great? Like,
it's so fun.
We've spent way too much time on this.
We talk about
podcast.
The Pelicans every week, man. I love their roster. It's a perfect – and it sucks that Darius Miller got hurt, because he's one of my fan favorites too. I really wanted him on the Thunder. But it's a perfect mix of, like, veterans that are clearly established in the league and do things really well in Drew Holiday and Favors and Redick. You've got – your young spice and Nikhil Alexander-Walker, Zion, who are going to be energy guys, even Hayes, who is just a project, but he's an energy guy. And then you've got a group of guys who are these guys who should all have chips on their shoulder from the Lakers experience. The baby Lakers. A guy in Ingram who's playing for an extension. A lot of guys with a lot of motivation to go there and be successful. And then you've got a coach in Alvin Gentry who's going to be free of the shackles that he put out there for us all to hear about with the Anthony Davis situation. I think that's just a combination for a fun mix this year. And I don't think it's a playoff team, but I think it's a team that can really be fun to watch on a nightly basis.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I'm so high on them is if – I was very low on those guys as Lakers, except for Josh Hart. I like Josh Hart
Hart.
I'm low on both Ball and Ingram. And so even if they give them nothing, even if those guys are the worst case of what I've always thought of them, Drew Holiday, J.J. Redick, Etwan Moore, Derek Favors, Zion Williamson, that alone is like a really competitive, a like veteran team with an explosive young guy that can take over. They're all competent veterans. Like a lot of where I get to when I'm trying to figure out who's going to be where is how many guys do you have that are what I call like definite NBA players, which are, I know they're going to be in the league in 18 months. And like most of the players on the Pelicans, I know we're going to be in the league in 18 months. And that I think really helps with it. If one of the Lakers guys makes a leap or is better than I think that he is, they're going to be even better. I'm exceptionally high on the Pelicans. Like I've had to tone myself down several times, reminding myself like, well, okay, they don't have like a superstar and Zion's really young and Drew, you know, like Drew's been healthy the last couple of years, but you still got to be a little cautious and JJ's getting up there in age. Like I've had to do all these things to kind of peel back on my expectations, but I'm exceptionally high on the Pelicans.
Assuming this works out really well for them, if you're AD, how salty are you that they didn't put this around you?
I think that a lot of it is, you know, I mean, they weren't going to have Zion, but, you know, look, like
when he first came in. Totally.
I mean, I have a different view on this because kind of like with Presti, where I'm like, let's really look at it in context.
Sure.
You know, if we're in an NBA now where it's like you better win when they're on their rookie and their first extension or you're going to lose them. This is what the Pelicans did. Like, they traded for an established he was an all-star. It was 1 year, but he was an all-star. And Drew Holiday, a guy who's great defensively and a great shooter, and then he just could not get healthy. He just had a bad stretch of 3 years where he could not get on the floor. Eric Gordon, great, won sixth man of the year in Houston. Everything was excellent. Had horrible knee issues when he was with New Orleans. Ryan Anderson wound up being like pretty useful, at least for one season toward the end of his, like, you know, whatever his prime would be considered to be in Houston. Again, couldn't stay on the court. The real mistake was they got Omer Asik, in part because of AD's reluctance to play center, which the Lakers are now dealing with. You know, so some of this is I look at it and go, like, look, man, if you had just said, like, yeah, I'll play, like, let me play center, it's where, the, you know, I'm willing to do the banging and get down there, I think that they're probably in a better spot. I think the Pelicans tried to put a winning team around him. I think that they made an effort and made pretty, like, they made mistakes like anybody does, but they made, I think, for the most part, decisions that at the time made sense that didn't work out. And I think mostly, like, you know, AD wanted everything that he got, and he got it, and now we'll see if it works out for him.
Who's your next team on the list?
At 37 wins, I got the Oklahoma City Thunder. So I'm hedging there pretty significantly. If everybody stays healthy, I think they're a 500 team. I think they're in the Western Conference, they're probably 500 to 43. If they keep everybody and everybody stays healthy, but you factor in health and the risk of them, you know, doing what we kind of talked about earlier, I still have them over because I can't justify putting a team with that kind of talent lower than 37 wins. But I couldn't go up there as close to 40 as I maybe wanted to. It's a stay away number, even I think at the low points. But I think that, you know, let's say that Chris Paul has like a standard amount of missed games for a player of his age with his meniscus history, and Danilo Gallinari, who has missed consistent time throughout the last couple of seasons, he misses, say, like, you know, 2-3 weeks of action. The rest of that roster probably isn't good enough to hold them up. So I think below 500, but a really pesky team that's probably hanging in the playoff race to the very end is an upside for the Thunder.
Yeah, it all depends on who's around. And it's just that first month is going to be really rough for them in terms of the schedule. And then, you know, once December 15th comes around and everybody can start moving players, it's just going to be interesting to see how quickly they deconstruct or how much they say, you know, we're going to or how difficult it is to move some of these guys, like a Chris Paul, for instance. I don't think Gallinari will be a problem. I think they'll be able to move him. But it's just, I would not want to be a person who is trying to gamble on this team and try to figure out how much and what to do with this, because it's just going to be so volatile.
Right.
What about after the Thunder? We can guess the teams, but what order do you have them in?
So let's see. Fourth worst is the Dallas Mavericks, who I am as low on as I think anybody you're going to find.
Yeah, but you know what? The people who have come in on this podcast have been higher on the Mavericks than you, and I just don't feel it with Kristaps coming back for the first year. Post that injury, I just don't see him coming back and immediately being a guy that you can say, okay, this guy's going to take this team up another level.
I've been much higher on them than Eric has, but, you know, once you get down this far, you obviously have a bunch of question marks.
I just, you know, I've never been, and he has, with his injury concerns alone, like, that's a reason to knock them down considerably. I think he's a little underrated in terms of what he's able to do as a rim protector. I think he's overrated as a perimeter weapon. I think you can switch and attack him more than people kind of think you can. I don't love his perimeter game. I don't think that he's like a lights out, you can trust him to carry the offense from the perimeter kind of guy and create on his own. That helps next to Doncic, obviously, but it just, you know, a little bit not as good as you know, some of the estimations have him. My big problem, though, is like, look, Doncic is awesome, fantastic, amazing player, great rookie season, going to be an amazing player in this league. Porzingis, you know, unicorn, could be a star, you know, tall, can shoot, can finish, so athletic, despite 17 knee injuries. Like, okay, cool. Who's their third best player?
Like,
yeah, yeah. I mean, you have to say somebody like a Tim Hardaway or something like
Dwight
that.
Dwight Powell?
Yeah, Dwight Powell, you know, Tim Hardaway, Maxie Kleber.
Tim Hardaway, yeah, Maxie Kleber, who, like, part of it, the way I've kind of described it with the Mavs is, it's not that I don't like any of these guys. It's that their third best player should be their fifth best player, and their fourth best player should be their, like, everybody's two spots up. Like, Tim Hardaway Jr. as your fifth best player is like, oh, okay, he's like a, you know, a big rangy two guard that can get hot on some nights, is inconsistent, but, you know, can at least spread the floor a little bit. That's fine as your fifth best starter, but when he's your third best player, you're in real trouble. Like Dwight Powell, like, oh, springy, you know, stretch 4/5 that you can put in various situations, can do a little bit of switching, even though the defensive numbers are not great, can finish at the rim. Okay, but like, that's a guy that you want is probably like the sixth man off the bench and not as your third or fourth best player. So you look at all of those guys, like, I'm high on Jalen Brunson, but even if you move him up, like, these things are still not where they probably need to be. So I wind up just being like, I think the Mavericks will be interesting. I think that Doncic will still be great, but I cannot put them at 40 wins in a brutal Western Conference, given where the roster is at.
Yeah, and how much is Kristaps going to play? And how much is he going to be able to play? Especially when you think of it this way, too. He's going from the Eastern Conference to the Western Conference. And we mentioned the brutalness of the Western Conference, but just think about the all-star guards and the all-star wings he's going to have to go against, and that are going to get – he's going to get switched on to in isolation. This is a guy coming off of a devastating knee injury. Like, how much are they going to be able to even keep him on the floor is a question. How much is he going to be able to do for them? So this was already a guy who is at 7'2 or whatever he's at that, you know, you didn't want on an island. And now he's going to be having to go against, you know, Damian Lillard and Steph Curry on consecutive nights. And just the level of competition he's going to face nightly coming off of that injury, that just gives me concern about Dallas and their ceiling. Not just when he's coming off the injury, but going forward too. So I'm not very high on Dallas right now.
I've bumped them down since, I think I originally had them at 10, and I've moved them back down to 12, and who knows by the time we finalize where they'll be for me. But basically, my excitement about the Mavericks entirely hinges on Luka and how much of a jump he can make this next season. And yeah, basically I'm fangirling out for him.
Yeah, I think, you know, you talked about Porzingis, that you talked about the guards, but I think with the bigs that he's going to have to go against defensively, like, every night it's going to be LaMarcus Aldridge, Anthony Davis, Nikola Jokic, Karl Anthony Towns. Like, there are some really great, tough, physical big men in the Western Conference. Steven Adams, like, he's going to be facing those guys every single night. I think that that's going to matter with his durability. Like, I'm as high on Luka as anybody, but I do think that we tend to, especially, we don't really look at what happened to him and the Mavericks after they traded all that talent at the All-Star break. Because when they did that move to go all in on Luka, which is a move I support, you know, his numbers suffered and the team suffered, and his plus minus showed it. Like, they weren't able to win with Luka on the floor because they didn't have the talent. And Porzingis is expected to make up all of that. And that, to me, is a lot to ask of a guy with KP's resume.
And then your final three.
Wolves at 34 wins. I have no feel for them. Don't know. Like, Ryan Saunders, like, everybody loves him in Minnesota. It's really he's a well-liked guy with the media. It seems like he's a smart dude, but I didn't see anything of them late in the season for me to feel good about them. I loathe every minute that Andrew Wiggins is on the court. Karl Anthony Towns is amazing. I don't like that they got rid of Tyus Jones. I think he's an underrated young point guard, and Memphis, I think, got a steal with him. I'm not crazy about, you know, moving Saric. Like, there's just all of these things where I can't really grasp the moves that they kind of decided to make in the offseason or where they're at. And I'm just kind of like, I guess we'll see how this works out. I'm higher on the Suns than almost everybody. I have the Suns 14th in the West.
I'm
higher than the Suns than everybody. One place higher than everybody else.
Yeah, but I do have them at 32 wins, and I have them hitting their over. Their over is preposterously low at 29.5. They have a lot of NBA dudes. Kelly Oubre, Ricky Rubio, Tyler Johnson, Dario Saric, Aaron Baines. They added all these NBA caliber caliber guys. So no matter how many questions I may have about Devin Booker and DeAndre Ayton, and I have quite a few, they'll be better than last year, but they just won't be able to win enough to really be competitive in the West. And my last team, simply because they are just too young to do anything about it, is the Memphis Grizzlies, who I have at 24 wins, despite thinking that their future is unbelievably bright with Ja Morant and Jaren Jackson Jr. and Brandon Clark and Jonas Valanciunas. They have a lot of players, I think, that are good, but young teams don't win in this league, and these young teams do not win in the Western Conference. They are going to have a hard time getting over. I think they're going to face those situations where they're up by two with 6 minutes left in the fourth, and the veteran teams are like, we're not losing to this team, and they won't be able to keep up. So I have the Grizzlies 15th with 24 wins.
Yeah, they're interesting from a Thunder standpoint, because they're also going through I'm just going to use rebuild as the whole overarching term. Sorry, Sam Presti. But they're like half a step ahead of the Thunder, because they really started tearing down at the trade deadline. And so, no guarantee that the Thunder is going to follow the same game plan, but you could, in the next coming years, see the Thunder get much younger and have more of that, you have to look at the future and the promise of these guys as opposed to whatever they're going to do right now.
Trust the process.
Yeah.
Oh, the Grizzlies are well on their way.
Yeah, Eric, you'll notice that you were talking about, like, you must have some really bad teams. I actually don't, because I have all of the bad teams in the East. They're all really of the bad teams.
Let's see, right. Do you have the Knicks at 55 wins?
Oh, man.
I'm somehow, like, despite everyone's low expectations of the Knicks, I think I'm lowest on them. I had to bump them up from 19. I had them originally at 19 wins. And I was like, well, no, okay, like Bobby Portis and Taj Gibson and and Julius Randle.
Yeah, the New York power forwards.
The New York power forwards. Yeah,
I was going to say,
the New York power forwards and Elfrid Payton are all NBA players, so yeah. I should give them at least 20. So I have them at 22 now. They are the lowest team in the league at 22.
And it's like...
Them and the Lakers have all of the power forwards.
And it's like, you look at like the deals they gave those guys, and you're like, oh, those are bad deals. It's just that they gave all these guys deals at the same position. Right. Like, it's like, it's like, how are they going to, how is this going to work? What?
I'm excited, though, for like a situation where like there's just a rash of, not excited because I don't want anybody hurt, but like say there's a rash of power forward injuries across the league, and all of a sudden,
Knicks are like, ha ha ha.
Yeah. Perry are like, we have the market. We've cornered the entire position.
That's my fantasy strategy. I have a million wide receivers now and no running backs, but no one will trade with me, and I'm just like twiddling my thumb as I'm losing, but late in the season.
I will not humor you all with my fantasy football. that is not going to happen. Matt,
if you want to learn more about it, go to actionnetwork.com. We've got great rankings. Sorry.
Great plug. Matt, I have one more question for you before you leave, which has absolutely nothing to do with basketball.
Sure.
I was browsing your Twitter feed, and I happened to notice that you have a strangely higher knowledge of Our Lady Peace than anybody I've seen in quite some time. What is your favorite Our Lady Peace album? I'm going to give you mine. It is Spiritual Machines, which I think is severely underrated, and it was kind of their experimental album once they said, okay, we've established ourselves and kind of done the things to establish ourselves. We have some hits here and there, but we're going to go crazy with this Spiritual Machines. Give me yours.
It's Spiritual Machines. It's absolutely Spiritual
it's
Machines.
Fantastic. Because, it's fantastic. It's outstanding.
It's a concept album built off of Ray Kurzweil's works on artificial intelligence. Like, it sends you down this, like, after I heard that album, I went and read Kurzweil in college and was like, this stuff is amazing. And so much of what he wrote about is like coming to fruition now that we have the technology to catch up. It is exceptional. The album is like, it's got absolute bangers all the way through.
Yes.
It's like, it closes on a strong note. It's the album rules.
It's there. It's, And for people out there who don't know Our Lady Peace, they probably heard Somewhere Out There. They probably heard Clumsy back in the late 90s. And they're a Canadian band who had a little bit of success in America in the late 90s, early 2000s, when rap rock was really at its peak. They were kind of on the outskirts of that. They weren't a rap rock group. They were basically just an alternative band.
Yeah.
But Spiritual Machines to me is their best album, their most complete work. And I think in the 20 some odd years since it's come, probably 18 years since it's come out, and me and a couple of my friends really got into it when we were living in Louisiana. I've come to think of it as kind of a less dense version of like Radiohead's OK Computer, because Radiohead's OK Computer is kind of what people hold up as the kind of prescient, ahead of its time album that you could basically play now 20 years later, 22 years later, and say, okay, this totally plays in 2019. But Spiritual Machines is one that I think was pretty overlooked in regard to, you know, how ahead of its time it was, and kind of looking at, you know, technology and how technology was going to take over and the machines and all that stuff. And, you know, kind of in that Matrix-y Radiohead OK Computer period where we were all obsessed with the future.
We've really sandwiched this conversation with some fascinating topics.
I had to talk about it because I saw it on Matt's Twitter feed, and I just don't get to talk to many people about Our Lady Peace.
So what's great is, okay, so the entire album is interlaced with these interludes with Kurzweil reading excerpts from his book, or at the very end of it is a conversation that's held with an artificial intelligence. But here's what's great. Part of what that album is also about is a singularity where our consciousnesses are uploaded to a digital frame. So we started this conversation talking about before it's too late, and we end talking about perhaps it will never be too late because perhaps we'll live forever in a digital space.
Wow, that was beautiful.
Time is a flat circle.
Thank you for bringing us around to that.
One of my best friend in the world who still lives in Louisiana, I just put him on in the past couple of weeks to that ending of Spiritual Machines, where you have to basically wait 15 to 20 minutes before the conversation kicks up. He had never known about it. And I'm like, dude, how have you not known about this? We've been listening to this album for 18 years and you don't know about this? And he's like, and he went and listened to it and his mind was blown. Like, anyway, anybody out there, I highly recommend it. Our Lady Peace, Spiritual Machines. Even if you're not into alternative music, give it a listen. It's one of the last few albums of that genre, because we're not in albums anymore. We're in MP3s, what have you. But it's an album you listen to from start to finish that has good segues and good good kind of structure.
Take the over on Spiritual Machines.
Take the over on Spiritual Machines. Matt, we are friends for life, now and forever. Thunder Buddies for life. Thank you for joining us today on the Thunder Buddies podcast. Greatly appreciate it, man.
Thanks for having me, guys. I loved it.
And thanks for you all for listening. Thanks for subscribing, downloading, and sharing on Apple Podcasts and on the Thunder Buddies blog.
If you haven't done it, do it now before
it's too late. Make sure. And we will see you next week with a little bit of a preview going into Thunder Media Day, which is September the 30th.
September the 30th.
Training Camp opens on October the 1st. I can't talk. And we'll come back on probably after Sam Presti does his thing where he gets up there and says things but doesn't really say things. But thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.